We're talking edge defenders this week. Why are they all aging so well? Also, why the left side of the defense is the place to be, who's ready to break out in 2019, and of course, our ranking of the top 10 edge defenders in football. It's all on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We are talking edge defenders this week. Edge defenders, not just edge rushers, not just pass rushers. And these are the guys who typically, these are your defensive ends, your outside linebackers.
A lot of them too, didn't you think? Like a lot of them.
You're going to be really happy when we get to the unveiling of the top 10 edge defenders in football, because we just didn't have that many guys get votes this week. We all had pretty similar ballots. Others receiving votes are it's going to be short. It's going to be a quick one.
Well, that's lovely that we're doing that. I think there are other receiving votes. I'm looking at them now. They would look, we could pass this off, the first five guys who missed the top 10, we could pass it off as somewhere in the top 10 and nobody would notice.
It was a
deep position.
Yes. It was a deep position. It was a tight vote to get into the top 10, which I'll get more into when we get there. But this is also the first one, I believe, this year where three different guys got first place votes.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's exciting.
Very exciting. Well, we will have that a little bit later in the show. But before we get to that ranking, we are going to talk some general topics here. And Andy, I actually want to start with this. So many of these guys, whether it's Calais Campbell, Michael Bennett, Jerry Hughes, Cam Wake, Ryan Kerrigan, these are all guys in their 30s. And then on top of that, we have guys like Von Miller, J.J. Watt, Cam Jordan, who will be playing their age 30 seasons in 2019. Mm-hmm. You would think a position like this that obviously it involves a lot of athleticism and explosiveness, you would think it's not a position where guys age particularly well, but that's what we're seeing. And I guess my question to you is, I have my theories, but why, Andy? Why are guys here aging so well?
Yeah, that's a hard one to answer, because what I found when we did that all old team, I think it was, the best old players, is there are a lot of them who are in their early 30s who are good, but once you hit age 32 or so, you tend to wipe out of the NFL pretty quickly. So to see Calais Campbell on here, Michael Bennett, Cam Wake, Terrell Suggs, these guys are in their late 30s. They're not just 30s. They're in their late 30s. I don't know why. I agree with everything that you said. I think technique's a big deal with defensive line play and edge play. But technique's not everything. I think it's a bigger deal for interior offensive line play than it is for edge play defensively, for example. So I would imagine you do need your athletic burst. I mean, what's your theory? Let me hear yours.
Well, I was going to say, we've talked about in the show, like, you can't beat Terrell Suggs with misdirection. He doesn't get fooled. And with the increase in misdirection-based plays, the NFL has that sort of, I don't want to say put a premium on guys who can read these things and rarely take a wrong step, but does it make those guys more valuable?
Perhaps, but these guys that we're talking about, when I put on a third down and long situation on film, I feel like they're still viable. Like, I don't watch Suggs and think, like, well, he's lost a step, but he can still be out there because he knows what he's doing and you can handle him real well on first and second down against misdirection. I don't feel like they show any decline when their veteran IQ isn't a big factor. On just athletic-based plays, I think these guys are all still viable.
It's pretty wild, and we'll have plenty of these guys when we unveil the top 10 rankings later in the show. I don't know. Do we just give up on this question, Andy? Do we not have a good answer?
We could solicit people to send us a talkback, because I know our listeners might have some answers, but that's what's so complex, is that these guys do not look old at all. It's not like Larry Fitzgerald, for example, looks old, but he's still great because he does a lot of other things well. He's very technically sound, great hand, smart football player. That's not true with Terrell Suggs. Terrell Suggs does not look old, and Calais Campbell does not look old. Michael Bennett, they haven't slowed down and adjusted their games. They've just continued to play at a very high level, and I don't know why that would be, especially more at this position than other positions. Because the one position, Gary, where there are almost no old players at all who are successful. If I told you there's one position like that, which would you guess it would be on defense?
I would say practically cornerback.
You think that, yeah, I would have guessed that too. It's linebacker. Old men do not make the NFL in their late 30s. They don't stay in the league very often. Sean Lee is a very big outlier. Slow. There weren't a lot of slow linebackers either when you break the league down like that. So it's just interesting at which positions you can get away with being a little bit older and slower of step, in which you can't. Maybe edge is one of those positions. Maybe, I guess. But again, these guys that we're talking about, I don't think they're slower of step.
I wonder if wear and tear plays a role in linebackers, not aging.
Yeah, they're more physical.
I said cornerbacks just because cornerback is so it's so dependent on speed and quickness and movement skills.
It is, and it's all reactionary as well, which I think takes more athleticism to react to that kind of thing rather than, like Fitzgerald, back to that example, he can play slow because he knows where he's going and the defender doesn't know where he's going. So it's harder to – and maybe that's part of it here is edge rushers are edge defenders. That's a very proactive position. You're usually in the attack mode. Linebacker, you're reading and reacting. Corner, you certainly read and react. Safety, you read and react. Defensive linemen, and especially on the edge, you're the attacker. The offensive line is typically reacting to you. We're talking pass plays, of course. I don't know if that would factor in at all.
No, I think you might have stumbled upon at the very least, an intriguing theory here. I mean, you are the aggressor. You know where you're going when you're a pass rusher.
And maybe that could be it. And the other thing that we have to keep in mind is when a player implements his technique very efficiently, he looks more athletic than he actually is because the efficiency just is so smooth. So Calais Campbell, he might tell you, yeah, in an honest moment, the guys never say this, but if you got him with some truth serum, maybe he would say, yeah, I'm not quite as explosive as I was 3 years ago, but I'm better with my hands. I'm better with my first step mechanically. You know, the guys learn this, and a lot of it, it's just learning to scout and attack offensive linemen as well. Little tips that those guys give you when they're blocking you, that can help you a lot. And I would imagine a guy like Suggs has 15 or 20 things he looks for in an offensive lineman to get a tell on a play.
Yeah. Well, let's put the focus a little bit more on pure pass rushing at this point, and I guess more pure pass defense. Baltimore and Kansas City, those are two teams that last year, they dropped their edge guys into coverage a lot at a higher rate than most other teams. I think Justin Houston was dropping into coverage like 20% of the time last season. So I guess it's a two-part question. On one hand, what's the logic behind doing so? And on the other hand, why does it work so well for Baltimore and really didn't work so well for Kansas City?
Well, these are good teams to contrast because, yes, they both drop guys into pass rush, but they do it for very different reasons. So Kansas City, and I don't think it will continue like this under Steve Spagnuolo, who's now their defensive coordinator, but I saw Bob Sutton, their previous coordinator. He's with the Falcons now. So when I went and did I spent the rookie minicamp with the Falcons, Sutton and I sat in the lobby for about 30 minutes and just talked defense. And I asked him flat out, why do you, because when he was first in Kansas City, Sutton was blitzing as much as anyone in football. And by the end of his tenure there last season, he was dropping 8 into coverage more than anyone in the NFL. It's a big wild shift for him. And I asked him why, and it was very simple. He said, quarterbacks throw the ball so quickly. So why would we send the bodies after the QB? If the ball's just getting out, we might as well crowd the passing lanes. And from my sense was there really wasn't much more to it than that. Mm-hmm. So that's his philosophy. Now, the Ravens are a different philosophy. They send 5 pass rushers on a lot of their plays. They'll play zone coverage and rush 5, fire zone blitzing. And as part of their fire zones, they usually overload one side and drop from the other. So if I'm the left defensive end, we're showing pressure from my left side with all these other guys around me, but we're actually going to bring the pressure at the last minute from the right side, and I'm going to drop back. And that's really the foundation of Baltimore's method to defense. So their defensive ends wind up in coverage, but it's because of the way the pressure designs are working, as opposed to Kansas City, where they just, for the last few years, have believed in 8-man coverages.
I kind of wondered, and specifically with Justin Houston, who, again, as I mentioned, he was probably back in coverage on about 20% of his passing down snaps last year. But I remember back a long time ago, probably like 10 years ago now, Lamar Woodley, Steeler great, Titan and Raider person later in his career. But we talked about this a little bit, and I kind of said, like, boy, it must really get your goat when you have to drop into pass coverage instead of rushing the passer on a play. And he said, no, because it's like getting a down off without having to come off the field. Like, sometimes it's nice just to be able to get a little breather by dropping back. So I wonder if that is sort of helping Justin Houston stay healthy while not pulling him off the field. I wonder if that had something to do with it as well.
Well, maybe. I mean, for one, Lamar Woodley had a little bit of a reputation as a guy that noticed when he had some time off or the availability to catch a breather. But Dee Ford will drop into coverage, too, when he was with Kansas City. I think a lot of the who drops is dependent on the formation. You know, the other guy who does this, Gary, it's Vic Fangio, and he's now in Denver, of course, but he was with Chicago last year as their defensive coordinator. That kind of brings us full circle. We've talked about the Chiefs that drop 8 into coverage. We've talked about the Ravens that drop 6 into coverage and rush 5. And now the Bears, or now the Broncos, they rush the traditional number of 4, but will drop a defensive end into coverage because they're just trying to create the effect of a blitz without actually blitzing. And Fangio's done that a lot. Even with Khalil Mack last year, there were a lot of instances where Mack would drop into the flat or and base downs on just first and second down. If the Bears are in their base package, you can make an offensive formation dictate that Mack would walk out over the slot. When Fangio was the defensive coordinator for the Niners, the Ravens in the Super Bowl that year employed a lot of base slot formations, meaning all their wide receivers were on one side and the rest of their base personnel was on the other. And what that did was make Aldon Smith have to walk out over the slot receiver. And all of a sudden, Aldon Smith was a non-factor as a pass rusher in that game. Yeah. So you can dictate to some of these guys. Fangio's willing to live with the trade-off. He's that big of a believer in disguising his seven-man zone coverages. But there are a lot of different reasons you would drop a defensive end into coverage. I would bet 99 times out of 100, it's just a function of the scheme.
Okay. No, I was shocked. I was just playing around with the numbers today and the league average for edge players dropping into coverage was 8.1%, and I was surprised to see Mack up there at 12%.
Oh, was so, he? There you go. Yeah. Who else had some high numbers?
Kyler Fackrell
for Green Bay
was the league
leader. Another team that shows pressure.
34.5%. Whitney Merciless, 30.7%.
Let me back up on Fackrell. He's probably miscast a little bit too. That's probably part of his natural role.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's miscasting the data, I mean. Like he might not be a pure edge defender in Green Bay's mind. Whitney Merciless was one.
Yep, Whitney Merciless was also over 30%. Those are the two guys over 30%. We had let's see, TJ Watt, a couple of Steelers way up there. Watt, Chiquillo, and Bud Dupree were all in the 17 to 22% range.
And that's because the Steelers subscribe to that same Fangio belief. The Steelers show a 5 down front. We call it 3-4, but really it's more of a 5-2 with those outside linebackers up on the line of scrimmage. And the whole idea is we're going to send 4, but because we're in a 5-2 and it looks like we're sending 5, you'll never know who the 4 are. And one of these guys will drop into coverage. And offenses, they know this going in. Teams scheme a lot of how we can attack TJ Watt in coverage, and for a defensive end or an edge guy, he's a very good coverage defender, but he's still an edge defender, often going against running backs in space, sometimes even tight ends and wide receivers. So again, it's all part of the trade-off of the defense. You're hoping that by dropping a guy into coverage, you confuse the quarterback just enough that he holds the ball and you give your pass rush that much more time to get home.
J.J. Watt, who is in our show this year, he's been the defensive line show in past years. This year, we just went off of PFF's game charting stuff and are kind of trusting them. They classified Watt as an edge for last season, so we are going to include him in the show. But he, 676 passing play downs, dropped into coverage twice.
And I guarantee you Whitney Merciless took note of that, because when I sat down with a Texans coach this offseason, I said, Whitney Merciless was invisible this year. I would imagine you guys aren't going to have him back because Merciless is not cheap. He's got a $8 million cap, something like that. He's up there. And the coach said, well, Whitney was asked to do a lot of different things in our scheme this year, and he had to drop into coverage a lot more. So it's you're taking one for the team when you do that sometimes.
Good man. Kind of speaking of Whitney Merciless here, because he's a guy who has been so effective over the years, basically moving inside and being, lining up over the center and being an interior rusher. Do you have anyone in the league, I guess Merciless could be one of them, who you really like in that role, a quote-unquote edge guy who can move inside and attack effectively from there?
Yeah, Jadeveon Clowney, which is why Merciless is the guy that keeps dropping into coverage, because Clowney is unstoppable at times as an interior rusher. There's no question at all that Clown is a better interior rusher than outside rusher. I mean, it's not even close. And he faces guards a lot. The Texans, they don't line him up in a stance like a defensive tackle very often. He'd be good if he did that too, but they bring him from a stand-up position. Essentially, he's an individual blitzer. Mm-hmm. And so he attacks these guards with a head full of steam. And Clowney, with downhill momentum and his violent hands, that's where he's at his best. He's not a bendable guy, though. He's not flexible to turn the edge. Merciless is a lot more flexible than Clowney. Watt's a lot more flexible than Merciless. That bendability around the edge, which I'm sure we'll talk about a lot when we get into the top 10 guys, that's key. But Clowney doesn't have it, so they rush him inside a lot more.
Well, let's just go to the top 10 guys then.
Fine.
I mean, if it's okay with you.
Yeah, I can live with it. Yeah, no, we're good. Let's do these top 10.
We got Ryan Taylor this week as our third voter again. Ryan Taylor, a brilliant legal mind and also a wonderful voter. Our votes were wonderful this week. We only had 22 guys get votes. We each submit our top 20. That's some consistency right there. So we are going to start with Andy's favorite part of the show, others receiving votes, and Andy, there's not many of them this year. Only 12, excuse me, this week.
But the time that we save on not reading the other names has been more than given back by you announcing that there aren't many of these guys still, it's still a waste of time.
And you're going to be super bummed when I get down to 13 and I point out that there was a very, very small spread between some of these votes here. Mostly because, as we see every week, whoever doesn't make the top 10, there are going to be 40 people on Twitter like, hey, D Ford, what do you think of this? Hey, D Ford, you need to make this list. What do you think of this?
Do people do that?
The number one thing in my mentions this past week was people tagging Lane Johnson, which is confusing at first because I just look at my notifications and I'm like, anything going on? And just a bunch of people tagging Lane Johnson. I was like, why are people tagging Lane Johnson? And then you go back and someone's like, oh, Lane Johnson didn't make the offensive line list. And now Lane Johnson is motivated to have the best season of his career.
Lane Johnson did a nice tweet to me a few weeks ago. I forget. It was something about the value of the right tackle position.
Yeah.
But I don't think we heard from him on this. So he's a gentleman on Twitter. That must be how that works.
If
he were his best every snap, he would be top three. But Lane Johnson's a little bit inconsistent mechanically.
He was like 12 on our list. People are fired up that he wasn't like nine. He's like 8 or 9, not like 11 or 12. And that's Twitter. But let me read the others receiving votes. We've got Jerry Hughes, Terrell Suggs, T.J. Watt, Brandon Graham, Bradley Chubb, D. Ford, Michael Bennett, Trey Flowers, Frank Clark. Now listen, I just want to point out, this next one I'm going to read is number 13. 13-9, they were all separated by 1 point. So it went 42 points, 41 points, 40, 39, 38. So these are basically the same guy. Just don't
worry about the Twitter people so much. Come on, it doesn't matter what they say anyway. Just go ahead and do that.
Anyways, the last three others receiving votes, Danielle Hunter, Jadeveon Clowney, Miles Garrett, just outside the top 10. We'll get to the top 10.
Garrett would be my other answer, by the way, for who's better rushing inside than outside. Although, our conversation with Donovan Smith last week kind of shuffled my thinking on that a little bit. I think Garrett's a very good nickel defensive tackle potentially, But Donovan Smith's point was that Garrett takes such long strides in his lower body that you'd rather him be on the edge because he needs the space to commit those strides rather than inside where it's more of a choppy step kind of movement. I thought it was a great point.
It was. Donovan Smith is a bright guy. You can hear his interview on our last show, last Monday, the offensive line show. But let's get into it. Number 10, Calais Campbell. Number 9, Melvin Ingram. Number 8, Yannick Ngakoue. Calais Campbell, usually he's on the defensive line show. He's on the edge show this week. I don't know. I'll just ask again. Does it make sense to see him more on the edge, or would you rather just see him, just playing inside?
Well, Jacksonville so often will crash him inside in their stunts and their twist designs, whether he's setting up someone else or he's looping inside to get the potential sack himself. So in that scheme. And Yannick Ngakoue is even better at that to some degree. He's a more agile version of Campbell as an inside looping defender or an inside crasher. So in that scheme, for a defensive end, where you line up isn't necessarily where you're targeting your pass rush. So I don't get too tied up in where Campbell aligns. It's more with him. It's more about where he finishes the play. And often he finishes the play inside. The guy is a 6'8". 3, whatever you are when you're 6'8 and thick as hell. Campbell's an inside dominator.
Number 7, Chandler Jones. Number 6, Joey Bosa. And so we had Bosa and Melvin Ingram make the top 10 again this year. I guess, and I'm just thinking back to a single game, and it's silly to draw broad conclusions off of a single game here, especially against the greatest quarterback of all time, but the way you can neutralize those guys with quick strike stuff. Does it kind of make that Seahawks style defense that approach of just relying on those two guys to generate all this pressure? Does it make it a bit flawed?
Not necessarily, because the theory behind that Seahawks-style defense is we're going to rally to the ball. We're going to tackle you. We're going to make you earn your yards in small increments. So if you're getting a quick strike offense against that, you still feel like you can rally to the ball. It's just that your linebackers become more important in that game than your defensive ends in that one. And you also believe, hey, one incomplete pass or anything that puts the offense off schedule – it's now third and long, and that's really what we're paying Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram to do here for us. Yeah. So I don't think it diminishes it a whole lot. I will say this about those guys, though. Individually, they're immensely talented, and we just talked about stunts and twists with Jacksonville. Ingram and Bosa, I think, are the best tandem for that in all of football. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, they need to play better, at least more consistently. They need to play at their highest level more consistently. There were too many times in the last couple years, and injuries have been a part of it, where they go quiet for weird stretches. And I think both of these guys are good enough to be every down dominators.
Number 5, DeMarcus Lawrence. Number 4, Cameron Jordan. We'll start with Lawrence, and we talked about him a little bit during the offseason because he had the contract situation. He's staying in Dallas, but I don't know. It's almost like when you look at this list. We'll get to the top three, but you look at this list, and it's almost like if you were going to say you have to pull one of these guys out of their defense, and who would have the biggest effect? Like who would feel it the most if you took this guy out of their lineup? I almost feel like you could make the argument that DeMarcus Lawrence is that guy
for Dallas. Yeah, you probably could. Because Cam Jordan, interestingly, he's another guy that drops into coverage a decent amount, especially in the red zone. Jordan's pretty valuable to the Saints, too, though. Dallas's scheme is a touch more dependent on four-man pressure than the Saints' scheme is. The Saints are a little more diverse schematically with some of their fronts and their design concepts. So I don't disagree with you on DeMarcus Lawrence. And it was nice to see him get paid this offseason. Both of those guys, Lawrence and Cameron Jordan, are, I think, in my opinion, they're every bit as good against the run as they are against the pass. And I thought early in their careers, especially Cam Jordan, I remember when I thought he'd be a defensive tackle ultimately because he did not look very explosive around the edge early in his career, not for first-round pick status. And I mentioned that to him, and he said, yeah, the, you know, coaches were trying to make me a defensive tackle, and it just never quite got all the way there. Unfortunately, it didn't because he is extremely explosive now, which is another illustration of what we talked about earlier about how your technique and your timing and your football IQ, that can make you look or even be more explosive athletically because it's such an efficiency to your movement. I bet you Cam Jordan is no quicker physically now than he was when he came into the NFL. He's older now than he used to be. And yet he plays a lot quicker now.
He's also a dude, and there's no real deeper dive on this or anything like that, but he is always hovering around like 1,000 snaps per season. He's always among like the guys who are on the field the most over the course of a season, which I guess is just extra impressive that he's been this good for now. This will be his 9th season coming up.
Great point. Yeah, he does not come off the field a whole lot. And the other thing we ought to touch on this, well, let's remind me at the end. I'd like to count up how many of these guys play on the left side predominantly and how many on the right, because that'll tie back to the point that we're always making, Gary, which is that right tackles are every bit as important as left tackles in offensive line play.
The top three, Andy. Each of these guys got a first place vote. It was very tight here. Number three is Khalil Mack. I thought that was really surprising that Mack ended up third in this vote. Number two is J.J. Watt. Number one is Von Miller. There you go. I just spoiled the whole thing.
Oh, no. Yeah, eventually everything gets spoiled if we're going to get to the ending at some point.
That is very true.
I thought the final episode of Breaking Bad really spoiled the series and the storyline there.
Well, I mean, Andy, you're
telling us what happened.
It's really the second to last episode. It was the true finale. So that's kind of what spoiled what happened. But
You mean that? You believe that?
Well, you knew he was going to die at some point. Sorry if I just spoiled Breaking Bad for people.
God.
But that was bad.
No, we need to edit that out.
The second to last episode. The second to last episode was where...
I think that's a horrible thing we just did.
What do you think, Brandon?
That has to go out. That has to go out. I would be furious.
We're keeping that.
I was just saying, that show's like... What? The finale was like 5 years ago.
Doesn't matter. There's a certain website out there that has written some, not horrible thing, but like they've been very critical of me and they've had some harsh headlines about what a doofus I am. And I was still fine visiting that website every day until one day I came across it and there was a Walking Dead spoiler in the headline. And I never went back to that website again. I didn't care what they said about me or what they implied about my family, but when they spoiled a show, that was the worst offense they could have committed on the internet. That's the harshest internet crime there is. Next to like actual internet crimes.
Oh, do you want to, Brandon? Are you editing this right now?
No, not at the moment, and we're going to keep that segment.
Okay.
Oh my goodness! I like that. All right,
I like that.
Sorry, Andy.
No, apologize to all the people who have had Breaking Bad spoiled for them.
The final episode is a little bit anticlimactic. Can we agree on that? The second to last episode is where, like, everything happens.
I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to be at all associated with this. I'm a big believer in watching shows years later because it gives you more flexibility in how you binge them.
Okay. I will take that criticism. And then
Terrible of you.
And then I will ignore it. How's that?
We've had other issues with you spoiling, Gary. What was it? The Houston Texans overtime game 2 or 3 years ago. That you spoiled. You said it wasn't much of an overtime, not a very long overtime.
That could have been anything, though. Could have been a pick six. Brock Osweiler was a quarterback in that game. Could have ended in any way.
But that doesn't... It still ruins the viewing experience, because if I know it's not a very long overtime, then if it's third down and three, I'm thinking, wow, it's probably unlikely they'll convert this, because if it's not a long overtime, then there's not going to be a very long drive here. So I'm thinking they'll not convert third and three. And all of a sudden, I've now had less fun watching that third down and three play.
But then you're at the edge of your seat, thanks to me. Thanks to my setup. Thanks to my foreshadowing. You're welcome.
Foreshadowing. That's a fancy word for it.
We simply foreshadowed the end of Breaking Bad. I can't believe that was spoiled for anyone. Maybe literally like three people. That's about it.
It's a principle. It's the principle. It's about drilling good habits. We can move along. I mean, I've seen it, so I'm not. I feel bad for our listeners that we hurt. But we were going to count these edge guys.
Unless
we need to talk about Mack and Watt and Miller. I don't know if we need to dissect why one is ranked ahead of the other. They were all top three for us. Just a matter of what order you put them in.
It's essentially.
I don't feel strongly one way or the other, though. I think I had J.J. Watt number one. Wasn't I the J.J. Watt voter?
Yeah, you had Watt, I had Miller, and Ryan had Mack. And the fact that I think it was your third place vote for Mack that ended up being the difference between him and Watt in second
place.
But
all of
there,
us had those guys as our top three in some fashion, didn't we?
It's essentially a three-way tie for first.
Yeah, well, there we go. But let's count up. So, like, if we're counting the number of guys that play on the left side, I'm looking through our list. Let's go back to number 15. Trey Flowers is predominantly a left side player. Danielle Hunter, that's two. Calais Campbell's three. Joey Bosa's four. Lawrence is five. Jordan, Mack, Watt, and Miller, they all play on the left side. So that's 9 out of 15 are left side defensive ends mainly, which means they're facing right tackles. So once again, I think right tackle pass protection is enormously important. And also remember, when the left defensive end beats the right tackle, the left defensive end is closer to the ball than the other linemen are because the quarterback is right-handed.
Closer to the ball, and as you made the point back in the day when you started this trend, you are in the field division of the quarterback.
Yep, which we can debate if that's a good thing or a bad thing. We got so caught up with the blind side stuff because Michael Lewis, that book, and then the Michael Orr movie. And look, that was a great book, great movie. Well, it wasn't a great movie, but it's a great premise, great conversation that we had about it. It was smart football, but what happened is everybody felt like, oh, I'm going to be the smart guy and say left tackles. Yeah, they're just as valuable as everybody but a quarterback pretty much. When in fact, you could argue that having a quarterback be impacted on the front side rather than the blind side does more for your defense because it impacts immediately the way the quarterback plays. If there's blind side pressure, well, if the pressure doesn't get home, which usually it doesn't, let's also keep that in mind. It's hard to get to the quarterback. Mm-hmm. If the pressure does not get home, then the quarterback is none the wiser, and he's often climbing the pocket and still functioning on schedule. He doesn't get spooked the same way. But if you can generate noise on the front side, some of the quarterbacks, especially the young ones or the bad ones, you can really make them screw themselves up in the pocket by making it look like you're getting home on the front side.
Yeah, that's the argument I would make, that you're usually not going to get home for the sack anyway, so the next best thing is disrupting that quarterback in some way, shape, or form, and the best way to do that is to, well, basically be seen.
Yes. Yeah, incompletions should be considered a part of the pass rush statistical equation, because a lot of good pass rushes just lead to incomplete passes because the quarterback has a poor platform or he's under duress.
Before we move on to the lightning-ish round, Andy, should I tell everyone the end of the blind side?
You can tell that one because no one's watching that way. Let's give them a clue. It was a happy ending.
I didn't see the movie. I read the book. I didn't see the movie, though. So please don't. And now I know it's a happy ending, so now I guess I won't see the movie.
Yeah. Well, PG Disney movies tend to fall that way. They don't teach you a lot of hard reality lessons with PG Disney movies.
The lightning-ish round, Andy. Fastest 4 hours in sports. Here we go. First one, who would you rather have in 2019 regardless of salary? And I guess this is a Patriots question, but Michael Bennett or Trey Flowers?
Trey Flowers. I don't think that's a hard... Is that,
yeah?
Is that close?
Not close? I'm surprised.
I don't think it's close. Maybe it's close, but it's very clear. Flowers is not a whole lot better than Bennett, but I think he's clearly better than Bennett.
Okay. All right.
What would do you disagree? I mean, Bennett's a great, I don't want to slight Michael Bennett. For a long time, people within the NFL thought Bennett was the most valuable guy on that Seahawks defense,
yeah.
And there were basically seven all pros.
Okay. All right. I was surprised by your answer. I thought you were going to hem and haw and And
no, not that, the lightning ish round.
Yeah, and
no.
that would fill 4 hours right there. Guy outside of our top 10 most likely to win defensive player of the year in 2019. You know what? I'm going to say outside our top 11 because Myles Garrett was 11.
And you think Myles Garrett's the answer to that question?
Yeah, I think you're looking at the guys outside the top 10. I think Garrett's the answer. Because it ultimately becomes the question of highest ceiling.
Sure, and I think also these kind of questions to me are questions of public perception and voter yep. mentality. And someone outside the top 10, I would think it would be someone who is on a defense that goes from bad to good very quickly and yeah. then has big numbers with it. So which the Browns could maybe, they weren't a bad defense last year, but let's say the Browns fulfill expectations and go 11-5 and Garrett has 16 sacks and 4 forced fumbles. He'll get noticed by voters just for being a part of it like that. The guy that I think has the best chance outside of Garrett and maybe even better than Garrett would be D. Ford then for the 49ers.
Yeah.
I think the Niners have a chance to really jump defensively. They're not going to be a top 5 unit, but I think they can be a 12-4 team and 10-6 to 12-4 is something in there. And their defense can be a splash playmaking defense, and Ford would be a part of that. So it's defensive player of the year is just about whose numbers stand out the best a lot of the time.
I was going to say, similar to your thinking, I came to the conclusion of Frank Clark, that Chiefs defense becomes dominant.
Did you think it was interesting when at the time that the Clark trade was made, mm-hmm. and then the Ford trade to San Francisco was, I think, shortly before that, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure it was right before that.
Yeah.
They were around the same, you can look it up, but they were around the same time.
Yep.
But Albert Breer reported this, and I remember thinking it at the time that, yeah, Frank Clark's a better player than D. Ford. I understand why Clark was ultimately more expensive. Now, he was a lot more expensive in some ways than Ford. It basically was, 50% more expensive by money count plus a first-round pick.
Mm-hmm.
D. Ford cost a second-round pick in the trade at the end of, you know, from 30,000 feet. But when we're doing this list here, Frank Clark's 14, D. Ford's 17. I think I had them back to back. One's better than the other, but they're pretty close when you rank them across the NFL.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I don't know. I think Frank Clark has, I think he's a better three down player for whatever that's worth. No one's going to put that much stock into run stopping ability, but I don't know. It just feels like there's a little more of a ceiling left with Frank Clark, whereas I feel like we probably saw D. Ford's ceiling last year, and it's a good ceiling. And I think that might play into the perception a little bit, too.
D. Ford, when I went back through my film notes after that trade, D. Ford was a lot better last year than I remembered him off the top of my head. He was pretty effective week in and week out in all phases of the game.
Last one. I usually have one prepared for this, and I don't this week, so hopefully you have something ready. But a breakout player or a underappreciated star?
Oh, gosh. You go ahead.
Oh, gosh. I didn't have one. I'm rooting for Marcus Davenport because I would feel bad for him if you know, he didn't live up to the hype there in New Orleans after the trade-up for him. I'll just say, you know, I'm just going to say Jerry Hughes is underappreciated because he was one of those second act stars. He was a guy who flopped and everyone sort of gave up on him. And then he became the bull rush maestro in Buffalo here.
Yeah. I think Ziggy Ansah is not my answer to this question, but as I'm stalling to think of my actual answer, I will ask you, do you think Ziggy Ansah will do anything in Seattle?
No, but I don't know. I guess it would fall under surprised but not shocked if he did.
Yeah. What about Dante Fowler for the Rams as a breakout guy?
Yeah, you could say that. You could argue Dante Fowler. He had half a breakout last year.
If I were making a bet on it, I would want pretty good odds on the bet for Fowler. It's not a safe bet to me, but where he was, I don't know why I value run defense and defensive linemen so much. Probably because I think it makes a huge difference. When you can win on the edges defensively,
mm-hmm.
there's a marked difference in the way your entire defense looks as a run unit, as a run stopping unit. I thought Fowler was better down the stretch in run defense than anyone would have imagined, including probably the Rams.
I am going to actually change my... I still do like Jerry Hughes, but I'm going to say Harold Landry now that I look down
on
the list.
Tennessee's Harold Landry. That's a good one. In the first half of last season, he would have been in this conversation as top 15 anyway. He got, I don't know if he wore down in his rookie year or what it was, but he disappeared in the second half of his rookie season. I would take Harold Landry. I like Harold Landry as a breakout guy more than Dante Fowler, in fact.
All right.
That's a great answer. But I'm with you on Davenport as well.
Yeah. Davenport is more wishful thinking. I didn't see anything from Davenport that I think would make me say it's coming. I think he's a talented guy, and therefore it might come someday, but I don't think there's any evidence to argue for him at this point.
Well, he has the ability to generate speed to power, so you can get fast off the snap and then bull rush you late.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that D-line coach in New Orleans, Ryan Nielsen, is talked about around the league a lot.
Yeah.
As probably the best, certainly the best young D-line coach. He's probably in his late 30s, I would guess. Maybe early 40s, but he's one of the best in the business. A lot of those Saint guys have gotten better in the last few years.
Well, if Marcus Davenport has a big year, I will take credit for telling you so. And if he does not, I will also take credit for telling you so.
That's courageous of you. And we will not mention Ryan Nielsen at all in the conversation if Davenport has a big year. It'll be about you and me, especially you.
All right, that's a wrap for this week's show. We'll be back next week with the defensive linemen, the interior guys. Basically, anyone you didn't hear on this week's show who plays up front and you might be upset about not hearing them. Just give it a week. We'll get to it. But that'll do it for now. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, for making us sound smart. Thank you, as always, to producer Brandon Nix for putting up with all of our just nonsense in general and getting the show out into the public airwaves. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. We're still taking all average team. We are still taking second act stars. Send them to talkback@themmqb.com. You can also tweet us. You can get us on Facebook. Before we unveil all of those, we'll remind you all again. It'll be after the position ranking series is done. So soon, but not that soon.
Well, we'll do it in the preseason, so that way we don't have to actually acknowledge preseason football.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea at all.
No, because the more coaches I've talked to, you would be astounded at how many of them now, it's kind of openly, but it's privately, but they just say in very plain terms, yeah, we do completely different, irrelevant things schematically in the preseason because we want to give people a false picture.
Yep. Kind of the smart way to go about it. Well,
I think it's easier to do that on defense and offense. If you want to do it, because defense is not timing based as much, you know, you need everyone on the same page, but not at the exact same moment. Sometimes I don't know. It could be different.
I think that's fair. You're also, I think there's something to be said for, if you have young quarterbacks, that's the time they're going to be on the field. And maybe you actually want to run something that you might run one day. Maybe just a little bit.
Or you run a crazy play that you know will make the opponent have to spend an hour on prepping for it.
There you go.
Put it on film, as they say.
There you go. Everybody find your Taysom Hill and just go nuts with that this summer. But, I'll finish wrapping this thing up. If you don't already, please do subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys next week.